top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
In this house. In this house. In this house. In this house. In this house.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 4 of 5 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast. Skinamarink, skinamarinky-dinky-dink, skinamarinky-do, I love you. Well, not so much love, but no hate for this one either. Horror fans can be a tad difficult and petty and prickly. I mean, there's been a lot of poop flung at this indie small Canadian horror film that's picked up quite a buzz as it's moved over to Shudder, and it's difficult to see why, especially when some of the same people are the ones who would either rave about the terrible new Texas Chainsaw movie or just be completely besotted by the diminishing returns that you get in each of the Scream sequels, even though maybe the last one was fairly okay by the standards of modern reboots. Well, Skinamarink is a difficult film to process, but it's not without its merits. I mean, it is an art house film that is incredibly languidly paced and has maybe more in common with like a Louis Buñuel experimental film from 80 years ago than it does with any of the modern horrors that have been released of late. Its story and backstory is quite unbelievable. I mean, I think copies of it were leaked, if I'm not mistaken, onto Reddit, and it had this buzz surrounding it, not unlike the Blair Witch Project, and it's similarly very, very micro-budgeted, and it's the brainchild of Kyle Edward Ball, who's an Edmontonian and a Western Canadian, and it's weird because up until this point, if you thought at all about Edmonton and horror, your mind would probably cast to Mark Twitchell, the multiple murderer, who I believe was a would-be horror director who lured victims over to his garage and murdered them, inspired by the series Dexter. So, I mean, unlikely origins for this one, and an unlikely story, and an unlikely success story all around. And again, I mean, if you're going to cast aspersions and opprobrium in the direction of any movie, you would think that one that's so bootstrapped and so low budget would not be in your sights, because again, as I mentioned, there's so many worse big budgeted, paint by numbers, focus group tested films that just seem extraordinarily cynical and really rubbish and don't do anything to help, but mostly hinder the influence of the first, even if it's something that's not particularly riveting, like Jamie Lee Curtis in A Terror Train, which was apparently rebooted, sans Curtis, obviously, she's busy lady, but that one just disappeared into the ether without a trace, and in by all accounts was a pretty dismal, and but that's not even, you can't even really call that one out. There's been a lot of high profile horrors that are really not up to snuff, so taking your boots to stomp this little effort is somewhat misplaced, but that's not to say you can't be even handed in your critique too, because this is a passive experience to watch this. It makes Saint Maud look like The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. I mean, that one has some serious narrative sag, but if you watch this in small doses, skinny meringue, that's even impossible to say, it's like the song, I love you in the morning or in the afternoon, I love you in the evening underneath the moon, whatever. It's like a favorite of my son and lots of North Americans as a skinamarink, and now I'm the second Lombardo to add their version to that song, because I think Guy Lombardo, the band leader, did a version of it in the 50s, but it's a strange title for a strange movie, and at the core is this nightmarish dreamscape of a film that takes place in the 90s. It's interspersed with subtitles, and it primarily features kids. Well, I mean, it has two kids, Kaylee and Kevin, who wake up to find their parents have gone missing, and they just basically skulk around the house in dark shadows. And so this is 90s visual aesthetic with this kind of bloop analog, almost looks like crawling maggots cinematography. There's a lot of graininess, very analog sensibility, a lot of long protracted scenes of camera pointed down hallways and light fixtures and strange and off-putting Dutch angles and creaks and cracks and floorboards and carpeting. It's basically an interior horror writ large, where the house's interior provides the bulk of the backdrop. So, I mean, it's unique in that sense as well, because any of the other House of Horror movies, whether it's the eponymous house or the Changeling or litany of other films, whether it's Poltergeist or something that's typically based in a home, there's always the basement, and don't go in the basement, and the creaks that come from the rickety staircase as you venture down, and then the audience is basically shouting, don't go down there, basically. This one eschews that one, and those kinds of sensibilities, and I think would have been better served, or for an audience response, and I think this is at times almost audience resistant, skinamarink. But I think this might have played well in front of a live audience, because I think this is the kind of thing whose music and sound and bleakness and restraint, I think when it is punctuated by scares, and there are a few, I think that's the type of thing that could have been amplified by the sensory experience of experiencing this thing in a cinema, as most horrors, modern or otherwise, were intended. So, I mean, it's tough. You see these kids calling out for one another, and you see their bare feet walking around. There's an instance that I think would probably pique Stephen King's interest, where one of them looks under the bed. Obviously, the cliche is that's where the monsters lie. And there's scenes where, again, they're looking for their parents, calling out for them. There's phone calls. There's this... Most of this film, again, in this very analog kind of feel, is bathed in the light emanating from a television. So it has that in common with, again, Poltergeist as well, or potentially the mise en scène from Demons 2, the Lamberto Bava sequel, which there's lots of white light coming from the television, which makes for an interesting experience if you're watching this at night, as I'm wont to do with horrors. You have a room that you're watching it in lit by a television that is in a movie that's lit by a television. So it's one of the many meta aspects of this movie that really is, I think, pretty singular. You can't deny it. And it's easy to crap on something and one of my least favorite critiques of any film is just that it's boring. And to the extent that you could levy that successfully at this one, or maybe the Manos, the Hands of Fate, there has to be something else that you bring to the table to say, you can't just make some declaration without informing it with some kind of substance to buttress your arguments. Because sure, you could say that about the long stretches of nothing that happens in Manos, but there's enough even in that rather dull affair that makes it kind of quirky and odd. I think I would give it probably a similar rating to this one, but there's no denying that this is an execution of Kyle Edward Ball's vision. I mean, it must be incredibly difficult to film nightmarescapes. I mean, the obvious one would be Wes Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street and some of its really exemplary sequels. That, as an aside, I think is the best horror franchise of all time, just because the canonical films are all pretty good. And I'm not going to talk about the Jackie Earle Haley replacement of Freddy Krueger, but I think that series, pound for pound, has the highest highs and the lows that aren't that low. Again, if you just keep England in there as your baseline and don't consider the other one. Because I think all other series just fall short. But it really is hard to take on a gloomy nightmare sensibility and do it well. And I'm going to side with some of the film's numerous critics in saying that, yes, there's a lot that could have been trimmed from this, but that doesn't mean you have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, I would rather watch this plodding, meandering film than to have to endure the dunderheaded Texas Chainsaw from last year, which was just an appalling mess of a film on so many levels, and that was not boring at all. TCM was not boring. That was the least of its problems. It was just wrong on all fronts. And what's worse, right? I mean, that's basically a judgment call and a value judgment you can bring to bear. So, I mean, what is your takeaway from this? Everyone's sensibilities are somewhat different when it comes to, I think you have to give this film a little bit of credit, and if it'll help, I think you can watch it in maybe 2 to 3 installments and maybe more bite-sized chunks of about 20 minutes apiece, because yes, the runtime is rather protracted, and that's something that it shares with other movies that may have a more conventional straight-ahead narrative. But there's something to be said about this one, and there's some brief instances in which you just don't know what to make of this, and you are intrigued, and it has a hypnotizing feel. Again, maybe like a Chien Andalou or something. It has certain sort of Andy Warhol film kind of art house sensibility of these long shots, and you don't know what to make of it, and you don't know where things are going, and it's what adds to the what Germans call unheimlich, the feeling of unease that you get from this one is the public domain cartoon soundtrack that I think it has. I mean, a lot of black and white cartoon imagery. It looks like from the 40s or 50s, like a kind of Minnie the Moocher. Dun, 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 and that adds a very surrealistic element, as there's very, very little in the way of dialogue. I think there's been more dialogue between me and my building super in the last year than there is in this actual movie. But that's okay, because I think the children's voices, and you hear like Kevin say, "I'm scared," and that's a kind of intonation that little kids use before they can fully pronounce words, that sort of adds to the horror, as does the fact that there's a savvy use of subtitles for when they can't be heard. And I don't know whether that was an artifact of maybe the filming process where it really they didn't record it well enough, or whether it was an intentional stylistic move on the part of Kyle Edward Ball to make that a part of the film. Because as we've seen in other films, like especially the Romanian lensed film that I podcasted a couple weeks ago called Watcher, there's the background is just as important for a horror film. And in that case, there's a woman who's being spied on and in a foreign country and doesn't know the language, so and the language is not subtitled, so you have this disorienting feeling of empathizing with the lead. Similarly here, when there's no heavy soundtrack, whether you know prominently you got the likes of a John Carpenter or Goblin, who really made this an art form of the soundtrack, and obviously the Psycho strings and everything. But this is a resolutely quiet film, and again the only sound and vision is a David Bowie album. Like the lighting and the cinematography is bathed in television light, and what you get as most of your audio background is also what comes out of the TV, which flickers in and out as this very disorienting cartoon, because nobody is really familiar with it's not like it's some IP of some Disney thing. It's just some black and white. It's hard to recognize any of the characters. It's just public domain and that kind of jazzy big band kind of music that puts you in a different kind of headspace and a different time and place. It's something that I think Suspiria really amplifies and exemplifies in its almost Kafkaesque otherworldliness, especially when the girl is taken to the ballet school in the cab, and you're brought into a place that is not of any time or space. And this is supposed to be the 90s, it's some suburban home, but you don't know really where you are. And as the kids can't find their parents, what starts to happen is it's almost like the film The Poseidon Adventure, where you see this disorienting aspect of furniture being turned upside down and ending up on the ceiling, and dolls being misplaced and ending up upside down in some other room, and then Kaylee and Kevin calling out to one another, and these ghostly chimerical images of their mother appearing. And there are parts of this film that are really, really very jarring and very upsetting. And I think this is one of those instances where I'm going to probably take the middle lane, and I'm not going to veer off to either side to say that this is some masterpiece of psychological horror a la The Tenant or The Shining or The Changeling or something. But by the same token, as I think that has happened with the likes of AV Club and all these different critics, but by the same token, you can't deny the schism between the critics and the general audience, who's just dismissing it as boring. Because yes, there are facets. Like I was looking at the time, and I realized that within 15 minutes of the runtime, I don't think a word had been said at all. And then I looked again, and it was like 20 and 25, and these long stretches of carpeting and crown molding and banisters and all these types of signposts of domesticity and suburbia are just shown in this strange, withering, flickering analog light. And you start to ask yourself, where is this going? Well, I mean, don't take my word for it, but find out where it's going yourself. And I think that's one of the many things we've learned in this film. And I think I'm going to give it, for its ambition, I think 3 out of 5, and I think this is where our 5-point scale comes in handy. I think it very much lends itself to that kind of movie. I think depending on on your attention span and your ability to let it bathe you in its sensory experience, I think maybe anywhere from 2 to 3. I'm going to lean toward the three just because of the low budget sensibilities and just amazing way this filmmaker made his vision work out, regardless of whether you thought he did so successfully. Anyway, hope you enjoyed the show. Lots of things we learn on this one. It's another just almost audience resistant Canadian horror. Canadian horror is always a different beast. There's something about what we do here on the north of the 49th parallel as America's hat. There's something in the water here. There's something that's always happening, whether it's the likes of Infinity Pool or Possessor or all the different films that come out of here. Always something unique, an American Mary, Ginger Snaps, different takes, different sensibilities. There's something that Canadian horror brings to the table that I think is sui generis and really puts us on the map in a different way from anywhere else. I like to think I'm going to shout it from the rafters here, right? Oh, Canada, let's go here. And I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. Talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.